Is there a life after death? That question has been posed for all of human history, but in the early 20th century, after millions of lives had been sacrificed on the battlefields of World War I and lost to the Spanish flu epidemic, the search for an answer would reach new heights. As the bereaved desperately sought ways to connect with their dead loved ones, psychics and spirit mediums emerged from the shadows to offer hope and solace. By the 1920s, spiritualism was as in vogue as jazz, and in 1923, Scientific American magazine launched the era's most ambitious inquiry into the paranormal. Assembling a five-man committee of esteemed experts, the magazine offered a large cash prize to the medium who could demonstrate verifiable psychic phenomena. What ensued is a fascinating story of mystery and rivalry that screenwriter David Jarre has brought to life in his new book, The Witch of Lime Street, Seance, Seduction, and Houdini in the Spirit World. And it's a great pleasure to welcome David Jarre to the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us on this Halloween Eve.
Thanks for having me on, Jeff.
Very nice to have you. What brought you to this subject?
Well, I've always been interested in whether or not you can scientifically verify psychic phenomena. And during the era of the 1920s, it was a time where there was a real scientific quest to try and validate these supernatural effects. The underlying urge was to try to determine whether or not the dead survived. Because this was right after World War I, there was such a tremendous amount of carnage and death, and you had the influenza epidemic. So there was this collective yearning to want to know if the dead survived. And, you had major scientists who got involved in this study, Nobel Prize-winning scientists. So it's just a great era and a great prism through which to study the subject.
As you mentioned, it was very much in vogue, spiritualism. And talk a little bit about Scientific American magazine and how they went about this very ambitious inquiry into the paranormal.
Sure. Well, Scientific American was a really big deal in those days. They were a really popular magazine because the public relied on the Scientific American to let them know what new technology was really around the curve. And, what might be more in the realm of quackery. It was a time, of course, during the 1920s where there was just this new influx of technology and inventions, but also things that really were a little bit too miraculous to be true. So Scientific American was as much an investigative agency as they were a magazine. And the 1920s, of course, was also an era where there was this contest craze. So what the Scientific American wanted to do was launch a serious scientific study that was disguised as a contest. And what their purpose was and what their plan was involved choosing some of the most renowned scientists in America as judges of this contest, and then trying to find a great psychic medium who could manifest their phenomena before this committee of scientists. And if they were convincing, they would be awarded a large cash prize.
Tell us a little bit about how Harry Houdini came to find himself a place on this committee with these other members who are, quite frankly, equally interesting.
Yeah, well, Houdini was considered the world's expert on psychic fraud. Even before he earned renown as a magician, he was a false medium. He gave what was called a spook show during the Gilded Age, where he would manifest all this supernatural phenomena. And so he knew all the tricks of fraud mediums. Now, just before World War I, in 1912, Houdini's mother died, and he was devastated. He was really interested in trying to contact her spirit, and he sat in on a lot of seances. And then, when World War I came about, he really identified with the bereaved from the war, and he felt that most of these mediums were exploiting the post-war bereaved in the same way they exploited him when he was trying to seek a message from his mother. So, he was fascinated with spiritualism. He became close friends with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who was sort of the de facto leader of the spiritualist movement. And so after all the scientists were chosen to be a member of this judging committee, the next logical choice was a great magician who knew the tricks of mediums and, hence Houdini's involvement with the jury.
So now we talk about Marjorie, who is the so-called Witch of Lime Street. How did she get that particular title? And tell us a little bit about the background of Marjorie, who I guess you do read about whenever you read about Houdini in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, Marjorie makes cameo appearances in most Houdini biographies. But, you know, it's incredible how popular she was during this era. You know, she's a front page fixture on major newspapers like the New York Times and the Boston Globe in the summer of 1924. And what made her the great hope of the spiritualist movement was that, for one thing, you know, she lived in Beacon Hill. She was a member of the aristocratic Boston society. And so that, you know, nobody would in any way entertain the possibility that somebody from that class would ever be trying to defraud anybody. And her phenomena were just incredible. You know, she was a physical medium, which means that she manifested, you know, physical phenomena. Objects flew around the room, tables rose, apparitions were manifest. And, you know, a medium, when she creates physical phenomena, well, traditionally, in a mythic sense, she's considered a witch. So Marjorie was called the Witch of Lime Street. You know, she lived on Lime Street, which is a very elegant lane in Beacon Hill.
You make the point that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, as well as the scientist Sir Oliver Lodge, were largely responsible for bringing this revival to America in the early 1920s. How so, and what message were they trying to get across?
Well, spiritualism, which is this religious movement that was considered a new religion, is based on communication with the dead. And Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Sir Oliver Lodge really breathed life into this movement because they were so respected. Conan Doyle was essentially the face of the British Empire. He was one of the most recognizable Englishmen in the world. You know, he had incredible renown. He was the creator of a fictional character, Sherlock Holmes, that was the personification of deductive thinking. Sir Oliver Lodge was one of the most respected scientists in England. They both had lost their sons during World War I, and they both believed that they were in touch with the spirits of their sons through these spirit mediums. So they helped launch this occult revival, this spiritualist revival in England and Europe right after World War I. You know, they really seemed to have the answer for, spiritualism seemed to have the answer for so many people who had lost loved ones during the war. They both made tours of America in the early 1920s, and they launched this occult revival in America as well. About 2 months after Oliver Lodge came to America, Norman Rockwell painted his famous cover of a couple involved in the Ouija board on the Saturday Evening Post, and it just shows that seances and spiritualism and the Ouija had become almost a domestic pastime in the United States by the time Oliver Lodge had arrived.
And it is also safe to say that Doyle was responsible for bringing Marjorie to the attention of the Scientific American Committee.
Absolutely. When Marjorie tours Europe, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle sits with her, and he is just amazed. He thinks she is the perfect choice to compete for the Scientific American Prize. By this time, the Scientific American Contest had been going on for over a year, and they tested a number of different candidates and determined they were all charlatans, they were all fraudulent. But Marjorie seemed, you know, 10 steps above any other candidate. And Conan Doyle essentially discovers her while she's touring Europe, and he suggests that she enter the contest, and she does so.
What was it about her that captivated so many people? I mean, obviously it was the message, but there were many people who had that message. What was it about her and her personality that was able to take it a step further?
Well, Marjorie had this incredible magnetism and this incredible charm. She was young and beautiful, and she, you know, again, when you're talking about sort of the classic mythological reference for mediums and witches, they're seen as very seductive people. And Marjorie had this aura of beauty and voluptuousness and charm. You know, she was said to also be very seductive. But, you know, she became the avatar of the spiritualist movement, and she had the following of a movie star. This was a time when mediums were celebrities. So she really captured the imagination of the American public, especially because by the summer of 24, by July of 24, she was put on the front page of the New York Times, and it looked as though she was the first scientifically verified psychic medium in the United States, or actually in the world.
What was she able to do in front of people to convince them? perhaps not Houdini, but to convince other people.
Well, the thing about Marjorie is that, you know, she wasn't channeling mental information. She wasn't bringing through messages of the dead so far as the testing went. You know, she would manifest quantifiable physical phenomena. So again, you know, an object would move, a table would rise. She was giving all these kinds of tests that were devised by Daniel Comstock, who was one of MIT's great physicists. For instance, he put a bell box out of her reach on a table. She was restrained. She should not have been able to reach the box, but seemingly by her psychic force, at her command, or more precisely by the command of her brother, her dead brother, who was her spirit control. You know, when Marjorie conducted a seance, she always was said to be in trance, and the person, the discarnate spirit, I should say, who took over her consciousness or her being was said to be her dead brother. So her dead brother's name was Walter, and at Walter's command, this bell box would ring, even though it was physically out of Marjorie's reach.
So without giving anything away here in the ending of the book, what was she looking to do with this particular committee and showing them? What were the tasks put before her to allow her to try to convince them?
Well, Marjorie was married to a very prominent Boston physician, and he had been highly influenced by Sir Oliver Lodge. And, you know, they really believed that spiritualism was the coming religion. They really believed that it was the one religion that could be validated by science. And the more different scientific trials that Comstock came up with, the more it became evident that this was the most convincing way to show the public at large that spiritualism could stand up to science. And in fact, spiritualism and science were part of some sort of merging of a new metaphysical field.
And as you point out in the book, we're talking about being a physical medium, which is different than most mediums that we think of today, of a mental medium.
Correct. You know, some people have asked me if you could restage the Scientific American contest today. And the answer to that question, I believe, is really no, because you don't have physical mediums who do the same kind of things today, and you don't have physical mediums who would be willing to stand up to public scrutiny. The last one I can think of would be Uri Geller, who I believe it was in 1974 went on the Johnny Carson show, and Uri Geller supposedly was able to bend spoons through his psychic force. But, you know, Johnny Carson was a former magician, and he had been advised by the amazing Randy, you know, who was a famous psychic debunker, not to let Geller control his own spoons, so Carson provided them for him. And, you know, in this public forum where there were thousands of people watching this television broadcast, nothing happened. But it's also just evident of how far the art of physical mediumship has fallen. You know, Marjorie, as I mentioned, would manifest all these kinds of poltergeist effects. You know, she would be restrained inside the spirit cabinet, and all of a sudden, you know, the cabinet would just explode. It would be torn apart, seemingly by her psychic force. Voices would manifest from all parts of the room. You know, an Arctic breeze would come from nowhere. And, you know, in the 1970s, you have somebody who's bending a spoon. So it just shows you how things had changed.
So here we are, Halloween. Every year, there is an official Houdini seance. A group of people who are Houdini fans attempt to contact the spirit of Harry Houdini. You have attended some of these seances. What are these like, and what have you gotten out of them?
Well, they're certainly always very interesting. One of the seances I attended was in the home that was formerly owned by Eva Anna Fay, who was one of the great mediums of the Gilded Age, and probably one of the few mediums who was really on good terms with Houdini, because she'd admitted she was a fraud. And, you know, it was just a very eerie kind of feeling. She held her seances in the cabin in the back of her house, and that's where we held the Houdini seance. And, you know, it was in New England, and the branches were you know, the wind was blowing, and you could hear the branches rubbing against the roof of this cabin. And, you're surrounded by some former magicians from the 1930s and 1940s. You know, there have been some eerie occurrences, but to this date, I would say that having spoken to a number of people who've been attending these seances for generations, there's never been a convincing message that's come through from Houdini.
But maybe this year.
Perhaps this year. Who knows?
The name of the book is The Witch of Lime Street, Seance, Seduction, and Houdini in the Spirit World. David Jarrah, thank you very much for being with us, and congratulations on the new book.
Oh, thanks a lot, Joe. It's been great to talk to you.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book is The Witch of Lime Street. The book is published by Crown. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.